Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Last Defense. These are your hosts, Hanul Na'avi and Michael Belowski. We had a very interesting situation happen with our previous podcast. We had some audio technical difficulties that happened every time we seemed to, you know, talk about Chinese politics. We were speaking with a very special and renowned guest, James Corbett from The Corbett Report. You can find him at www.corbettreport.com. He's had us on our show a few times, and we've been on his podcast a few times. And we've had a very good time, you know, getting to know him a little bit personally, as well as discuss many political issues around the world in the Asia, and especially in the Asia-Pacific region. Now, Mike, what did you think about this last little quagmire that we had?
Oh, yeah, it happens. You know, I listen to the Alex Jones show, and he'll have a lot of his guests on Skype. And it just breaks down. It breaks down on live radio. It happens. I think it's just a part of life in the media. So the Skype gods were not with us today. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, it seemed to me like there's this little guy in a room in somewhere in China, somewhere in Shanghai. And he's just sitting there like, this guy sounds like a dissident. Click. And then, yeah. You know, we could not seem to sustain the podcast conversation, but we still got a lot of very viable and valuable information that we recorded about Japanese politics, Japanese economics. So we'll go ahead and give that to you guys very shortly. Now, before we get into that, is there anything else we'd like to add before we start that podcast?
Well, just that, like you said, I mean, I think we owe a huge portion of our audience to James Corbett. So, James, thank you. This is the third time that you've either had us on or been on our show. So, yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
Likewise, man. Like I said, he's done a lot for us. You know, I'm really, really thankful and appreciative of that because that's helped us to, you know, build a good rapport with people as well as, you know, just really help to fight the good fight, as I always say, and get our information out there. You know, we've connected with James. We're going to start connecting with, you know, new people as well. So, you know, and the support that we've received from him, you know, we deeply thank him and, you know, hope to see him again in a future podcast. So without further ado, this is our interview with James Corbett, which took place on Friday. I think that was March 8th. So Friday, March 8th, this is our interview with James Corbett.
Okay, well, first of all, this is a very unique broadcast. We're each coming from a different East Asian country. I'm in South Korea, Hanul's in China, and James is in Japan. So we've got the trifecta East Asian broadcast here. And anyway, we're going to focus on Japan today, as our guest is in Japan. So I'm going to go right ahead and ask about the new prime minister, Shinzo Abe. Now, I understand this guy, he has a family history from government. His father, Shintaro Abe, was a foreign minister. But perhaps more interesting, his grandfather, Nobusuke Kishi, I probably butchered that, was a prime minister, and he was also accused of war crimes during the World War II. Do you know anything about that?
To be honest, I don't know much about Nobusuke Kishi, but yes, I'm just briefly looking at his Wikipedia page here, and yes, he's been called Showa no Yokai, the Showa-era ghost or monster, so absolutely some shady parts of that past. I must admit, I haven't really looked into that. This is Abe's grandfather on his mother's side. On his father's side, his grandfather, Ken Abe, was also a politician, so he's got politicians all over his family tree, so that should tell us something about the way that the Japanese political system has functioned in the post-World War II era.
Now, he was already president, like, 6 years ago, right? And this kind of baffles me because typically when a president resigns, their political career is over. I can't imagine somebody like Nixon trying to come back. But he came back and he won with a landslide, like 70%. Can you explain what happened 6 years ago and how was he able to come back?
Well, again, this is really just a function of the revolving door of Japanese politics. It's something of an international laughingstock, and I think deservedly so. Prime ministers here tend to last about 1 year, sometimes 2 years. One of the few exceptions in recent years has been Junichiro Koizumi, who was prime minister for 5 or 6 years and enjoyed quite widespread support and managed to push through a lot of reforms, not all of them positive, I think, but still did a lot on the political agenda. But most prime ministers here tend to be extremely ineffective and tend to collapse quite quickly. And that was the case with Abe in his first go-around as prime minister, where he lasted 11 months. He was chief cabinet secretary for 11 months and then was prime minister for about 1 year, from September of 2006 to September of 2007. It's really just a function of some of the ups and downs of the ruling LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, which is pretty much the one party rule of Japan for the past 50 years. They've been out of power a grand total of twice for a combined total of, I think, what, 3-4 years. So in 2008, they were voted out in something else of a landslide. Maybe it was 2009. It must have been the summer of 2009, shortly after Obama took office. And there, the LDP's political rivals, the DPJ, got into power for a few years on the back of support, rallying around such promises like getting the U.S. out of Okinawa and things like that. That never materialized, and the subsequent administrations under the DPJ all started to fall apart quite quickly. And then, of course, Fukushima threw a giant monkey wrench into that works. So the political, the electorate here has just become disenchanted with the DPJ and are going back to business as usual with the LDP, which, as I say, has been in power for all but a few years of the last 50 plus years. So really, it's just a question of internal party politics in the Liberal Democrat Party. And it was Abe's turn to take the helm once again. I don't think it's interesting. The prime ministers come and go very quickly here, but I don't think a lot sticks to them particularly, except for the ones that resign because of some sort of, you know, corruption scandal or whatever it may be. But a lot of them just kind of come and go very quickly, and there's not a lot of time for the electorate to really hate them. So that would explain why you can come back from something like that. And that's exactly what's happened with Abe. And really, this is more of a vote of confidence for the sort of turn to the hard right in conservative in Japanese politics. I think there's some support among that, especially considering the rising tensions with China, etc. Abe has been very much a hardliner and is also promising monetary stimulus to try to get the Japanese economy, quote unquote, going again. So we'll see what transpires from this. But at any rate, that's sort of why he was put back into power.
Now, I've heard he wants to have like a constitutional convention or sort of readapt the constitution to allow for more military spending or aggressiveness. I'm referring to the treaty with the U.S. after World War II. They signed an agreement not to be aggressors and et cetera. And he wants to change that. Is that correct?
That is correct. The Japanese Constitution was drafted up under the American administration in the post-World War II era, and Article 9 of that constitution famously prohibits Japan from having an offensive military. They've only been allowed to have defensive capabilities. So they have what's called the SDF, the Self-Defense Force, or I can't remember what that stands for at the moment. But they supposedly only operate in defensive means or to support allies in various theaters around the globe. So, for example, they had some limited support roles in Iraq and places like that, but no offensive combat operations. And that's been hardwired into the Constitution for over half a century now, and it's extremely popular, I would say, in Japan. I don't know if popular is the right word for it, but I think it's very, very much part of the Japanese mentality now that this is a peaceful nation. They do not want to go to war again. They take pride, I think, in the fact that they are a nation that doesn't have an offensive military, at least theoretically, that's what's supposed to be the case. But in the last several years, we've definitely seen a shift in the rhetoric coming from the LDP and some of the hardliners that they want to revise the Constitution. They want to get rid of that clause, and they want to start offensive military capabilities. Now, to a certain extent, this is all smokescreen, because the Japanese Self-Defense Force it is a military, and it is capable of offensive combat operations on the drop of a hat. It could switch over and start doing offensive military operations quite easily. It has the infrastructure for that, and it is actually extremely well-funded and quite a large and modern force. It just hasn't been deployed in that way. But it's similar to the Japanese nuclear situation. Japan is not a nuclear power, quote-unquote, but they have the capabilities to start manufacturing weapons, again, at the drop of the hat because of the nuclear infrastructure that they developed under the guise of the civilian nuclear energy program. And, of course, that all came into question in the wake of Fukushima. But it, one of the things it exposed is that Japan does have capabilities to start producing nuclear weapons. So, again, this is all something of a smokescreen and something of just trying to get rid of the formal strictures against using their military offensive capabilities. But it is something that is definitely on the political agenda, and although I think the vast majority of the population would be against it, I could still see that happening, if not under Abe, at least sometime in the near future. And the fact that we've been seeing this increasingly popping up in Japanese political rhetoric over the past several years gives us an indication of where this is heading.
Mm-hmm. And I heard he was trying to pass a law requiring in schools children to be taught, quote, patriotism, end quote, whatever that means. But have you heard anything about that situation?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I used to teach in the public school system here, and it has been a point of over the past couple of decades, and I think increasingly so over the past decade, that Japan has been a nation that has had that post-war mentality for basically the past half century, where it has a large sense of guilt and shame has been bred into the Japanese population over what the Japanese people did and what they rallied around under the imperial flag back in the Second World War. And I think a lot has been done to try to drum that out of the Japanese population, and I think it's been quite effective, to the point where Japan is a nation where they will play, for example, the national anthem at certain events, but it's not something that people necessarily get all teary-eyed or put their hand over their heart about. It's something that, in fact, is quite uncomfortable. Even the Japanese flag, to a large extent, there are people who don't necessarily salute it. And interestingly enough, in the past several years, there have been, for example, at school ceremonies and things, they've been forced in recent years to play the national anthem and sort of face the flag while it's playing. And there have been teachers who have been fired for not refusing to stand up during the anthem, etc. And they took that to courts trying to argue that it was their right to not salute the flag or whatever, and they were unfortunately the courts upheld the school board's right to fire them for that issue. So this is something that's been sort of brewing for several years now, and I think it's just part of an overall attempt by the political class to try to change the sentiments of the people, because again, so many of the people I think do consider Japan now to be a past nation. They do not take pride in the imperial nature of Japan or what it did in the past, and there is that still that lingering shame and guilt. But the political class, I think, is trying to turn that around, and they're likely to start applying more, not just political, but perhaps even legal pressure to make sure that school boards and other things that are under their purview go along with this agenda.
Mm-hmm. And shifting to Abe's economic policy, even in international news, it's making news that he ran largely on a platform to crank up the printing press, so to speak, at the Bank of Korea. He even fired the head of the Bank of Korea, I'm not going to try to say the name. He fired the head of the Bank of Korea and replaced him with another guy who was more willing to print money. And what is this money going to be for, by the way?
I think you mean the Bank of Japan?
I mean Bank of Japan, I'm sorry.
Right. Okay. Yes. Well, this is interesting. Since the 1990s, the Bank of Japan has been theoretically independent from the Japanese government. It has theoretical independence. The Board of Governors, for example, the governor himself is appointed by the prime minister, but it's supposedly this independent institution. And it has, to a certain extent, resisted calls in the past for just printing yen and trying to get rid of the deflationary stagnation that Japan has been in for decades now. And what we're seeing now is Abe has, as you say, just appointed Haruhiko Kuroda, who was the former president of the Asian Development Bank, to be the new governor to replace the old Shirakawa, who's now Masaaki Shirakawa, is now now stepping out as the old governor. Kuroda is coming in, and he has been promising to use basically the Bank of Japan printing press to start injecting yen into the Japanese economy. And we're starting to see that shift taking place within the Bank of Japan itself, because, as I say, it's got this kind of nominal independence. And they have a policy board, and the members on that policy board determine some of the main policy decisions that the bank will take. And in a recent meeting, while Shirakawa was still technically governor, but on his way out, there was a call for an immediate start to an open-ended asset purchase that the Bank of Japan is planning to do. Basically, they've set aside 76 trillion yen, that's about $810 billion, to purchase assets directly from the Bank of Japan. So basically injecting that money directly into the Japanese economy, which is going to have an inflationary effect. Shirakawa has resisted that to a certain extent under his administration of the bank, but one of the board members, Sayuri Shidai, proposed moving this asset purchase, which has been planned for next year, moving it up, starting it immediately. That was voted down by the board generally, but this is seen as it's starting to shift. Basically, it's starting to shift away from Shirakawa and putting the brakes on this monetary spending into the Kuroda era, which will be just printing yen like there's no tomorrow, which was what Abe specifically has been campaigning on, what he's been talking about. This is obviously huge for Japan and the future of the Japanese yen, but it's huge for the global economy, because this has been seen as really the beginning, or at the very least, the first big volley in the currency wars that are shaping up, where not only the Bank of Japan, but the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, etc., are talking more and more about stimulus as a way of basically devaluing their currencies and getting inflation going, which is good for exports. But this is, of course, the start of a war-type scenario. I mean, there can be military confrontation just as easily as there can be economic confrontation. And it's important for people to understand that what we're seeing right now with these currency wars and the central banks opening up the printing presses and starting to inflate their currencies away is very similar, kind of eerily similar, to what we saw in the 1930s with the breakdown of international trade. A lot of people think the Great Depression was simply about the stock market crash and unemployment. But it was, in fact, also the beginning of an era in the breakdown of international trade where country after country was starting to devalue their currencies to make sure that their exports could be sold more cheaply overseas. And that started currency wars, and that started protectionist policies that were put in place in country after country to sort of protect their exports. And because of that, you started to get the real seeds of international conflict. I mean, it became in the 1930s, international trade started to stagnate, and the World War II sort of solved that problem, quote unquote, by ushering in the new financial order, which was founded at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944, which started the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency in a formal agreement between all of the allied nations. So it is unfortunately true that these types of currency wars that are exactly like what we're starting to see develop right now are the types of things that can very easily lead to open military confrontation. And it's harder and harder to see a way out of this era of quantitative easing that does not end in some sort of actual overt conflict.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of economics, you took over for the late Bob Chapman. Is that correct? His newsletter?
That's right. Yes, Bob Chapman unfortunately passed away last spring, and late spring, early summer, and I took over writing the introductory editorial to the International Forecaster. There's still about 40 to 50 pages of content. I'm only responsible for the editorial, but I am writing the editorial on a weekly basis.
Okay. I found this article. I was looking to talk about financial derivatives, which is a huge topic. I personally hate talking about it because it's like the elephant in the room regarding economics. It's such a big part of it, but it's so difficult to explain, even though I've been studying it for like 4 years. This article is called The Derivatives Mess. It's by Bob Chapman, and he talks a lot about Japan. He says that the exposure to financial derivatives, now financial derivatives in a layperson's term, I guess, would be like gambling with, for example, you hear things like credit default swaps, mortgage-backed securities. When they talk about it on TV, they say complex financial instruments, but He says that Japan has four times their GDP exposure to derivatives. And have you done much reading or writing about derivatives lately?
I haven't talked specifically about, for example, Japan's place in that context. I think it is, to a certain extent, it's meant to be dazzling and mind-boggling for people out there. And there's all sorts of big terms thrown around that are meant to distract people from what the underlying issue is. And I think the best way for people to understand derivatives and what they are and how they're functioning is exactly as you say, just to think of it as gambling. It is basically a way to place a bet on not the actual value of a company or a product or an asset, but in it's simply gambling on whether that the price of a certain company or value asset or whatever it may be will go up or down. And if you gamble correctly, if you bet it'll go down and it goes down, for example, you can make money. If you bet it'll go up and it goes up, you can make money. So this is something that has been sort of hardwired into the international financial structure for the past couple of decades, especially with the opening of the floodgates with the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the United States in the 1990s, which allowed these institutional banks to become basically banks had been split from their sort of savings and loan function to and their financial speculation function. And that was broken down, that distinction was broken down with the repealing of Glass-Steagall. And basically these banks became casinos, and they started to put a lot of their assets, a lot of their notional value is in these basically elaborate gambles that they've made that sometimes take very little actual underlying value, millions of dollars, say, and leverage it out hundreds or even thousands of times so that these deals are supposedly worth billions or even trillions of dollars. And the problem is that if and when this system starts to melt down, it wipes out all of that notional value and puts these banks in a position that it would be literally mathematically impossible to ever repay if they were ever called to repay them, which is exactly why the Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008 was such a big deal. It's because it was potentially the beginning of a worldwide meltdown in this financial phony derivatives market. So this is the type of thing that this is the entire house, what the entire house of cards is built on these days. And there's no way to envision this really melting away without it being some sort of catastrophic collapse that will take the entire world economy with it, which is why this is, I mean, you're right. This is really the underlying issue of the entire thing. I haven't examined specifically Japan's relation in this, but it is, I think, something that everybody should at least be aware of, to the extent that this is, as I say, what the House of Cards is built on. So if and when this starts to dissolve, the entire economic scene will be irrevocably altered. And that's something that people have been warning about for years now, but very few have been listening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to pass the questions on to Hano. What do you want to talk about today?
Okay. I wanted to cover some of the topics related to Chinese politics. Of course, we have a new administration in the Chinese Communist Party. So first off, I wanted to ask you, James, and by the way, I wanted to say thank you for coming on the show, and also, you know, thanks for supporting us throughout the time. And firstly, I wanted to ask you, with the new government under Xi Jinping, I wanted to see, how do you think that Chinese-Japanese politics will carry out over the next 10 years? What do you know about Xi Jinping so far?
Not a lot. I think we don't have a good sense on how he's going to govern, or more accurately, I guess, how his administration will govern, whatever you can call that, his clique of Communist Party leaders. I think there's a lot of backdoor, closed-door meeting kind of governance that goes on in China. So it's extremely difficult to really guess where things are going to go from here. There has been, in the last several years, a sea change in Chinese political rhetoric, at the very least, where more and more citizens have become concerned about corruption and the way that that plays into the Chinese political scene. And I think there has been more leeway for citizens to express some of that online. For example, there has been a sort of netizen movement that has identified and shamed various local officials for their part in corruption scandals, etc. And so far, I think there has been at least the indication that the Chinese leadership is going to allow this movement to continue, if not completely unfettered. At the very least, they are now starting to pay lip service to the idea of getting rid of the corruption that seems to be at the heart of the Chinese political system. So we'll see if that is actually the tack that the Xi Jinping administration takes. As I say, I think it's too early to really see what this is going to be like, but we did start getting the first glimpse into what the Xi Jinping era will look like this week or earlier this week when in Beijing they had the first the National People's Congress, where there were some, at the very least, some interesting statements. Again, even some Communist Party officials talking about the possibility of relaxing some of the restrictions against direct private investment in some key sectors, including energy and finance. So it is interesting to see whether or not that they'll follow through with that, or if that's just empty political rhetoric. And I think in the next year or two, we will probably have a much better grasp of that. And from that, we'll be able to see where things are going long term with some of the other regional partners and or foes, such as Japan. And that's going to be, I think, one of the major sticking points, because that the Chinese-Japanese conflict is a way of reading a lot of the different conflicts that are going on between the world powers generally. Because, right, of course, Japan is just basically a U.S. proxy and is certainly just a housing environment for the U.S. military and its presence in the region. So what is taking place between Japan and China might involve the Japanese and Chinese government, but probably more directly involves a greater quest for Asia-Pacific dominance that's taking place right now between the U.S. and China.
Okay, that was our interview with James Corbett, who lives in Japan, the western provinces of Japan, and he's been giving a lot of information based on Japanese politics. Although our conversation was a little botched towards the end due to Skype connectivity issues, we still want to thank him again for having us on his show and to discuss Japanese politics and geopolitics with him. So he mentioned a few points that I'd like to go over. First off, he was mentioning information about how Japan is a weak government. You know, the Shinzo Abe government seems to be conclusively weak. And we can only see in future that, you know, what kind of, you know, government agendas will get produced by this administration. And it seems like Japan has a long history of ineffective prime ministers and governments, according to his observations. However, we do see that there is a connection to this and how U.S. seems to use Japan as a proxy nation for, you know, geopolitical strategy against China and against South Korea or North Korea. What are your opinions on that, Mike?
Well, first of all, I just pulled up on, well, good old Wikipedia, but anyway, this is from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. And I talked about this in my last time when I was a guest on his show. Japan has the sixth highest military budget in the world. That's at about just shy of $60 billion per year, which kind of surprised me because, you know, I always thought, and we talked about this, Japan has a constitution formed largely by the United States after World War II that restricted their military development, but they have this huge military, so I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and you wonder, you know, there is a stark militarization of the government and of their own personal military, like you were saying, but you wonder why. What exactly would they gear up for? Is it any kind of preemptive militarization process, or is there any kind of possible necessity just in case the United States would need to use them in an allied attack against Chinese or North Korean offenses. So that's something that I would like to note and maybe get into more research later on. I don't know. It seems to me like I would just wonder why, you know, weak and effective governments would exist in Japan, you know, considering the history and considering the imperial ambitions that they previously shared. What do you think? How do you think that Japan has been evolving since World War II, post-World War II until now? Do you think that affects the government policies that they have these days? Is there like a complicity between the U.S. and Japan in all of their decision-making skills post-Marshall Pact?
Well, I think that I don't know about their overall history since World War II, but definitely recently, and especially the new presidential cabinet, I guess, they are moving towards more aggressive, I guess you would call it right-wing policy. Shinzo Abe is known to be a hawk, a war hawk. Well, he hasn't actually launched any wars, but his rhetoric is much more aggressive, especially when it comes to the island disputes, which we didn't really get a chance to talk about. I was just asking him about those right before Skype started going crazy. But as you know, as many people, even in the U.S. may know, Japan has territorial disputes with both South Korea and China.
Yes, yes, I remember we were going to get into the Diaoyu Islands, and Fu Ying, one of the spokespersons for the CCP, she actually mentioned something about that. She said that it was kind of Japan's fault for creating a lot of hostility in the area about the Diaoyu Islands, and so we'll get into that in a little bit. But what I'd like to also go on to... sorry, please finish your point. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that was pretty much it. And also, I asked him, and this was, again, after Skype was going crazy. I asked him, do you think that the West is influencing these conflicts between China, Japan, and Korea?
It would certainly work to their advantage. It would keep the militarization there and keep it strong. There needs to be a reason, you know, a raison d'être, you know, d'être. Okay, I'm butchering my little knowledge of French right now. But it would give them a reason to exist in that area. I mean, militarization is now based on, you know, private contracts. It's not so much a government, you know, needing to just bolster their military capabilities, but whenever there are periods of hostility, this makes money for, you know, certain contractors like DynCorp or you know, Lockheed Martin.
Halliburton.
It would be for people like, you know, Boeing. Even small contractors, you know, like what we have seen with Blackwater. These are all complicit organizations and businesses that work to help to militarize governments and countries. And in order to have that, there needs to be a constant threat. I mean, this is just my opinion, but I would like to do more research into that. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. We talked about that when I was on his show, especially when North Korea, there needs to be a threat in the region, so to justify military presence by the West in this area.
Yeah, it's a method of propaganda that's pretty effective, especially when rallying support for people domestically. Even what we've seen in the United States, when there's a war, you know, yes, people overall, we get tired of a lot of the wars, but there's still people serving in the military, and they do it because of several reasons, either poverty, or they do it for reasons such as, you know, nationalistic, you know, aspirations. You know, a lot of the propaganda gets fed into government, into movies, into cinema, and so people feel the need to serve their country. And what this does is this keeps the war machine going. So, you know, I guess moving right along to our second point that we talked about with James Corbett, or rather that you talked about with James Corbett, and he mentioned something about derivatives and quantitative easing in the Japanese central banking system. Now, could you give me a little bit of insight on that? Because I'm not well-versed or anything about Japanese politics.
Well, when it comes to derivatives, neither am I. It's a very complicated topic. The mainstream media calls it complex financial instruments, and I think, and James alluded to this when I asked him about it, I think it's intentionally complicated so that people can't figure it out. And again, to put it in layman's terms, I mentioned this in the original recording, it's like trading in a casino. You buy and sell futures and what are some of the other terms?
mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah, collateralized debt obligations.
Right, right. And basically, again, to put it in layman's terms, it's gambling by Wall Street, or in this case, it would be the Wall Street equivalent in Japan. I don't know what that's called, but in Korea, it's called Yoido, and I'm sure China has their own version.
Well, go ahead.
Well, they're very complex financial instruments, and they're used to create money that's not there, kind of like an extension of I'm having a brain moment here. The banking system, where they can take out, 100% on every 10% that's put into there. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Yeah. Like, for instance, if the weather's going to be sunny tomorrow, they can bet on that. And essentially, if it rains, then they can hedge their risk, or they can manage the risk for whoever is, signing on to the derivative, or even for the bank themselves. So it's pretty much a wager. It turns the entire financial system from productive to speculative. And since Japan has been having issues with currency, what he mentioned is that the market has been saturated with speculative instruments like derivatives. In addition, they've also been using quantitative easing to help, depreciate the value of the yen in order to help to stimulate trade with their markets. However, it can be a risky policy if things get out of hand, if they begin to print too much money and their market becomes unstable for whatever reason. It would make it a little bit more difficult for them. So, yeah. Any other points?
Well, I mean, I think you pretty much summed it up well. And he talked about how if the derivatives bubble, and it is kind of a bubble, if it goes, and it kind of did go in 2008, that was when you had Bear Stearns and some of these other big banks going under. But if it continues to go, it's going to be bad news. These derivatives got to be outlawed or taxed. And I just want to briefly mention, and again, we did not get James's opinion on this, but there is a group based in New York and Washington, D.C. called UFAA, United Front Against Austerity, and they are proposing taxing and or banning. Well, they're more focusing on taxing financial derivatives so that the derivatives will not be used, because if you tax them, it takes all the air out of the bubble, so to speak. It takes the profit away. Or if they are going to do derivatives, then it creates revenue that the government can then use for tangible production or whatever. So there is that, and I wish I could have asked James about that, but unfortunately, Skype did not. The Skype gods were not working for us. So, but in any case, I just want to put that out there and see what our listeners think, and they can check out UFAA as well and see what their opinions are. So
yeah, I can only hope that groups like the UFAA and the One People's Trust, which is another group that I recently discovered about, I hope that these groups can manage themselves well and hopefully create a tour de force against this derivatives crisis, because the only way we're going to be able to fix it is to band together and find practical solutions for these problems. I think that if we don't, then we're going to be at the mercy of a lot of these banking and corporate entities. So, my hat's off to the UFAA for what they're doing, also to the One People's Trust. I hope that they continue with the fight. We'll support them as well in whatever way we can, whatever manner. So let's just get to it. I guess the last thing that I would like to mention for, this podcast of The Last Defense is that we will in the future, due to the Skype problems and the inconsistencies, we will go ahead and do a Chinese politics podcast in the very near future, hopefully within a few weeks. And I'd like to get into some of the issues with the new administration, of the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, NCP, I guess, if that's the right acronym, and the, Xi Jinping, how he would compare to other government administration leaders like Hu Jintao, which he's trying to tackle a bit of the issues with corruption that developed over the last 10 years under the Hu Jintao government. But we'll get more into that later on. And hopefully that will be an amazing podcast to discuss, as there are many shadowy and shrouded issues concerning the new Chinese government as well as Chinese politics in general. So hopefully, you know, as a citizen here, I can help to shed some light on that, as well as we can get some expertise from people. And, you know, Mike, also, you know, your wealth of knowledge is also going to help us to shed light on this very, very nebulous situation. So I hope it makes for an interesting podcast. So any other points before we sign off?
Well, of course, you can find James' material at thecorbettreport.com. That's Corbett with two T's, report.com. You can also find his material at boilingfrogspost.com. I should probably check that, but it's Sybil Edmonds' site, the 9/11 whistleblower from the FBI. So if you just type in Sybil Edmonds, it's spelled just like it sounds, and then put in Boiling Frogs, I'm sure you'll get that. And he has post on there, and I believe he does a radio or a podcast for that also. And he also does, and he mentioned this in our conversation, Bob Chapman's International Forecaster. Now, he doesn't write the whole thing, but he does like a commentary every week, or a kind of, what do you call it, editorial. So Bob Chapman, rest in peace. He was a great guy. He, you know, did financial reporting on inflation and derivatives and all that kind of thing. So anyway, be sure to check out his material. We certainly owe it to him to, you know, send our listeners his way as well. So anyway.
Oh, I wanted to mention something very special, too. The Last Defense will be coming up on its one-year anniversary of being in existence on the Internet. So hopefully we can do a special podcast for that time, which should be somewhere within a week or two, you know, around the 21st, if I'm not mistaken. That was the day last year where we began this whole project. And, you know, once again, like I said, it's been amazing working with you, Mike, you know, throughout this one year. Mm-hmm. I remember when we were discussing this over beer about trying to, you know, fight the man through the Internet, you know, mm-hmm. and get our ideas posted out there. And now it's been a year and we've seen a lot of success so far. So, you know, thanks again for that.
Yeah, thank you. Gosh, you've been posting on the website almost every day. So it's been great. And I think I said James Corbett. Report.com. It's just Corbett Report. I can't remember what I said, but it's Corbett Report. So, but yeah, I mean, I didn't even realize our 1 year anniversary of the website was coming up. So that's awesome. We ought to do a special broadcast for that. I don't remember the exact day, but, you know, maybe we can figure it out.
Yeah, great, great. I mean, I'm looking forward to that one, man. I didn't expect for it to last this long or for the rants to keep coming like they do, but it just seems like, you know, we've been posting a bit of material, you know, some of it socialist, some of it libertarian, some of it free market, some of it based on technocracies, vaccines, whatever is out there, you know, we just want to kind of post stuff. Anything that helps to do with the struggle of, you know, human rights and struggle for solidarity within this world for the little guy, we're going to try to do it. So, you know, anything else before we sign off?
Nope, that's about it. I think we wrapped it up pretty good. So I guess that concludes our broadcast day.
Okay, thanks, audience, again. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you, James Corbett, for having us again as your guest. And, you know, we look forward to working with you in the future as well. You know, couldn't do this without you. Also, thanks again, listeners, for tuning in to us. This is The Last Defense. We are signing off.